doesn't sound good.
Podcast now, Panicly. Hello and welcome to the Hackaday Podcast. I'm Elliot Williams.
And I'm Christina Panos.
This is episode 386, DX Doomscroll Tamagotchis, Clavichords, and Vibrotrucks. In quick Hackaday news, the first spacecraft launched to orbit from Europe went up and put a bunch of little satellites into space. This is actually the second launch from hometown heroes, Munich's own ESA Aerospace. They are not quite on par with the lift from like a Falcon 9, but they're closer than any of the other new space competitors, which I think is really cool. As always, apparently, with early launches, there's some large chance that the whole thing is going to explode. And so they don't put the most valuable payloads on there. What I thought was really cool here is that the DLR, the German equivalent of NASA, ran a competition for you, yes, you, to put your satellite on this mission. And so, you know, you get a free ride to space, you take the good with the bad. If the thing blows up and there's some chance of it blowing up, you get to keep all the pieces, bring a net and head up to Finland. But it went successfully. And so six winners, which all, I think almost all, maybe one was not a university project. All the rest were university satellite projects, are now floating around in space. And there is much cheering in Ottobrunn, I imagine, which is like the southern suburb of Munich where they actually have their headquarters. I totally need to see if I can get a tour.
Yeah.
Ooh, that would be rad. And in honor of this, the DX386th edition of the Hackaday podcast, don't forget we're running a retro computing challenge. We'll throw the link in the show notes. Christina pointed out that we have
64 entries as of this writing, which was yesterday. For this, the 386th podcast.
The coincidences are piled thick, but you can destroy them by putting your project in. Head on over to Hackaday.io, describe your project, pull down the pull down to enter in the contest, and you'll be in the running for a $150 DigiKey gift certificate.
Ooh, ah. Or an honorable mention.
Ah, yeah. And we, of course, have honorable mentions, which are basically just an excuse for us to highlight our other favorite projects that weren't in the top three. And there are always more projects than three that are worth talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Many more, actually. Oh, yeah. And we just finished selecting the speakers for SuperCon.
Ooh.
Super, super excited about that. We had 150 talk proposals, and we managed by squeezing them all down, figuring out 2 tracks, 2 days, squeezing it down. We've got, I think, 30-something, 34, 35 speakers in the end, not including our keynote, which is going to be fantastic, but I can't tell you about yet.
Is that more submissions than usual or about the same?
It is. We usually get kind of 100-ish, I would say. And this time we got 150, dramatically more.
Nice.
Which is lovely. It puts our judges through the ringer, though. Having to not pick, you know, 120 talks is just soul-crushing. I mean, we try to put new people in the mix. So if you've given a talk before, I'm sorry, you got prioritized. We try to keep the balance of topics interesting. So when everybody writes in with a old school phone hacking topic, we can only really take one of those, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you very much to everyone who submitted a talk. We'll be getting half price ticket codes out to you. So it wasn't for nothing. Hope that makes it a little bit sweeter. Early
That's
bird.
Cool.
It's not fair to the people who submitted talks and therefore missed out on the early bird tickets. So it's the least we can do. Oh, we were talking about the space there. The courtyard at Art Center is gigantic. We're going to have a lot more space. We're debating whether people should be able to kind of self-organize into little zones. So we'll have like a retro computer village and like a, I don't know what village. You guys will have to self-assemble. But we may have more space than we used to in the alley, and I hope that's a cool thing. So yeah, get your SuperCon tickets. We'll put a link up if you haven't already.
Get them while they're hot.
And we'll be revealing the talks, toot sweet, probably as soon. As soon as people agree to give them, we'll be letting you know who it was. So maybe next couple weeks. Insert mailbag jingle here. We don't have one.
Oh.
But we really should. Mailbag jingle. So let's see what's in the mailbag this week. Oh, I got another one from Vic Oliver. Thanks, Vic. You mentioned various construction toys in episode 385. Oh yeah, someone was talking about prototyping using Lego. Years ago, I pointed out that one of the things only 3D printers will make is a Lego part that connects to a Fisher Technic part. Lego isn't going to make that, nor is Fisher Technic, and any other potential manager would get savaged by attack lawyers from both companies. But the power of 3D printing, you damn well can make one. Signed, Vic, a Meccano kid. It's funny, the context was Lego as a prototyping material because the submitter didn't have his 3D printer with him. And so it was like, you know, I don't have my 3D printer. I can't make arbitrary shapes, but Lego makes arbitrary shapes, and was having super good time prototyping with Lego. And then, of course, we spun off to, oh my God, all the Lego parts you can print. And Jenny spun off to like Meccano and Fisher Technic and other sorts of things. This kind of ties it all together. I've actually printed some of the forbidden Lego pieces. My son wanted to build like a rocket ship when he was five-ish, I think. And I printed a piece with two knobby sides 90 degrees from each other.
Whoa.
Yeah. So that he could put it down on one side and put the little engine part on the other. And then
isn't that what a snot brick is?
A who, buddy?
Snot, studs not on top. Snot brick.
Show me. Snot brick. I'm scared to type this in, frankly. Yeah, it almost is, huh? Oh, whoa, they have some of these. It absolutely is. I mean, ours was that with like a 45 degree angle between them. So,
whoa,
you know,
okay.
Two 4x4 faces, 90 degrees to each other with a, you know, like 45 degree angle cutting between them. But boy, this is very similar. Are these legal?
Yeah.
They're official Lego. Well, I'll be damned. Great comments in the show notes on this one. People who wrote in saying trying to 3D print Lego showed me just how amazing Lego bricks are, that their tolerances are so tight and so reproducible. And actually, if you look at them, they have all of these hidden features that make them like click together just right. And I will admit, after printing ours, I had exactly that revelation. I just sat there on the living room floor plugging Lego bricks into each other and pulling them out. There's something in there that makes for like a little click at the end. When they fit together right, there's a little positive extra snap. And I'm still not 100% sure how they do that.
Is there a ridge that goes around the inside? Or maybe just a tongue? Well, no, you'd see that sticking out.
The knobbies must be somehow like super subtly mushroom shaped, but then you couldn't do that with the injection molding? I'm not sure what it is. Or I'm hallucinating it. Another hack we discussed in last week's show was Alan Morris's effort to take a compressed version of Wikipedia and run it in a little browser application that he had written to run on the cheap yellow display, which is like an ESP32 based microcontroller board with an SD card reader. And that's pretty cool to have a real-time offline Wikipedia on a little piece of nothing that you could buy for $10. So super, super cool. Mendel Munkus writes in, he said, we used to do this back in the day for Rockbox, and he sent in some links for us to check this out. The original discussion is here, he says, archiving and compressing Wikipedia back in April 2018. Pretty cool. I want an offline version just because it'll load faster.
Yeah. I was linked to the best Wikipedia article ever written.
Okay, I'll bite.
Which is this one right here.
Unusual articles. A cow with antlers atop a power line pole.
It's a treasure trove. It's got an index over there.
Death from laughter. Yep, good, good. Oh, this is madness. Yep. Rocket garden. Landscaping and rocketry together at last. A skyscraper in Japan that has a highway off-ramp passing through its 5th, 6th, and 7th floors. Yikes. Cool, cool. Yeah, this is full of crazy.
I'm going to just take that out.
No, leave it in. Leave it in. That may be the best Wikipedia link ever. That is so awesome. All right, well, let's talk about some unusual hacks.
Okay.
First up from me, making a pole balance itself with propellers is a project by Peter Rysek. This is just such a great experiment. It's super akin to a quadcopter on the top of a long carbon fishing pole, except the propellers don't point up, they point outwards in all four directions, and it uses them to keep itself balanced. this sounds like an easy control problem, and it kind of would be, except he has a telescoping carbon fiber pole that he's using for this. So it's supposed to adapt to different lengths of pole, and he wants to be able to put his cell phone or an action camera or something up there on the top. So it also has to be able to adjust to different weights. And if you've ever tried to do like the kind of self-balancing PID controller on two wheels, this is that, but with extra lag because it needs to run these fans, with extra difficulty because it needs to adjust to changing weights, an extra dimension because it's not on two wheels. Oh yeah, and wind. Wind blows it over. Skipping to the end, of course, the project is a success. He has videos of him riding a bike, balancing the thing on his head. So, you know, it works, legit. It's pretty cool. What's funny is that in terms of the control, though, this is an exact mashup of the traditional, like, two-wheel self-balancing robot and a quadcopter. One of his first findings is that using blades and motors of exactly the right size is actually super important, because it's not how hard they push, it's how rapidly they can kind of spin up and down. And unsurprisingly, he ends up with kind of the quadcopter standard 5-inch three-bladed propellers. Even more unsurprising, he ends up using a bunch of the kind of motor control algorithms that people use in quads these days. In particular, if you think about a quadcopter, it wants to keep itself upright in various wind conditions, but it's got all sorts of noise. It's got four vibrating motors on it, and if you naively get the readings off of the gyroscope / accelerometer IMU unit, it will be all full of this crazy extra jank from the motors. And you spin the motors up and that motor noise changes frequency, and you spin them down and the motor noise changes frequency, and the wind comes in and it makes things vibrate. And so you've got kind of all of these different noise signals hitting the accelerometer and gyro that you need to null out. And he has exactly the same problem here. When he moves from the simulation model to a real model, he discovers that his carbon fiber pole kind of wobbles. So he also has the same problem of kind of unwanted frequencies in the control loop. Takes exactly the same solution that modern quadcopter firmwares do, which is to figure out where the noise is and run a dynamic notch filter on it to like hit out that frequency. And so he has, I can't remember, two or three dynamic notches working. They do tremendously successfully. The rest of the video is him just walking around, actually speaking of Munich, walking around Munich, taking this out and having people try to push over his Angry Bees monopole. You should watch the video. It's pretty funny. He gets it so well tuned that he actually could let the propeller spin all the way down, but he keeps them idling at kind of 10% anyway, so that they can react a little bit quicker. But that means that when it's idling, it's super quiet. And then so somebody comes up and presses it, and then it fights back with that like Angry Bees quadcopter noise, but it rights itself back up. He ends up doing a runtime test. He kind of foolishly started it sometime in the evening, and it turns to like the sun goes down, the moon comes up, and he's still out there watching this thing go. So it runs for at least 3.5 hours, and then I think he pulls the battery and calls it quits. So much more efficient than a quadcopter, because it doesn't have to lift its own weight, it just has to balance itself. And just a super cool kind of fusion of two of my favorite projects, self-balancing two-wheeled robots and quadcopters all in one. And it ends up using all of the lessons learned from both fields. So really, really cool.
Well, that brings us to my first hack choice, which it comes from Frigakmols, Slom Sack. No, it doesn't go backwards. From Frigakmols, free your rotary telephone from its wire. And really, that's all you'll have to free when it comes to physical parts of said phone. This hack leaves the original phone completely intact. It uses the original headset, rotary dial, switch hook, ringer, everything. The additional electronics that turn this into a cell phone are added without drilling, cutting, or otherwise mutilating the phone. In order to make this thing work, the phone is connected to a subscriber line interface module, which has all the electronics needed to simulate a copper POTS line. This module feeds audio and control wiring to an ESP32S3, which supplies the brain power and does the job of talking to a cellular modem. All the tones you remember are there, from the dial tone to the ominous dagger-like sound that takes over when the phone has been off the hook for too long. There are also some special codes in play here. One of them opens a wireless network for maintenance, and another one opens one for diagnostics. Now, this is certainly not the first rotary cell phone we've seen. I'm sure many remember the work of Justine Haupt, who made an open source cell phone with a rotary dial almost 7 years ago now. In 2022, a kit was made available. I will link both stories in the show notes.
So it's basically simulate an entire phone network and then hook that simulation up to a cell phone. I like it.
Oh, I also wanted to, a very long time ago, Caleb made a two phone talkie system for his VW bus.
Yeah.
Like 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I should link to that. Let me just put that in there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's surprising how little you need to make the basic phone intercom, right? Like, yeah. Hook them up in a big circle, get some voltage on there. But then making a ringer. Ringer circuit's a little more involved. Off-hook tone. That's on you.
I found a site a long time ago where you could listen to, it might have just been the old messages, like, the number you have reached is out of service.
Yeah, yeah.
023T, and they all had codes at the end.
Ooh.
Which I thought was interesting as a kid.
Right.
Oh, right. It's the number you've reached has been disconnected or is no longer in service.
Please check your number or dial again.
There you go.
Yeah, I wish I could do it. Yeah, you're going to have to find that link for us, too.
Okay.
All right, well, my next hack comes from Diffraction Limited. Boy, the name checks out. Printing micron scale benchies with resin and turmeric. This is a project to print the smallest printable objects you can possibly print. And by smallest, like, spoiler alert, he ends up printing a benchy and a Stanford bunny that are kind of about 2 times as tall as a human hair. When you put them up next to the hair looks absolutely gigantic. The hair does not fit inside the benchy. He does this in a surprisingly simple manner. He claims that his rig costs about $300. It's got 2 essential parts. One is a micro manipulator, and that's a previous project of his that he's got linked for you. And the other is a diode into fiber launcher. So diode laser into fiber launcher that he's got as a project. A little bit of optical work. Combine these two together and you basically get this printer. What it does is it drags a super tiny little single strand fiber optic through the resin and hits it with the 405 nanometer laser, thus instantly curing basically a cone out from where the fiber is. He puts a drop of UV cure resin on a piece of metal that he uses as his quote print bed. And you stick the fiber in there and you get it just the tiniest little bit off of the surface and you go zap, 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 zap. Strangely enough, printing with this is a lot like printing with an FDM printer, so much so that he just converts the units, but otherwise uses a stock slicer, which is really cool. The big problem here is that the original UV cure resin is so transparent that he ends up curing more of it than he wants. And what he wants to do then instead is just cure like the little bit that's at the front of the fiber tip. And so what he needs is something that absorbs that wavelength of light perfectly enough. What absorbs blue light? Yellow stuff. What's yellow? Turmeric. And so he has this little extraction method where he gets the, apparently it's called curcumin, the yellow pigment out of turmeric. And basically it's put alcohol in there, extract it, and you've got pure curcumin. Mix that in. It has 2 benefits. One, it fluoresces green under blue light, so it's really pretty. But 2, that fluorescent green basically absorbs all of the blue wavelength. And so that means when he pulses it out of the fiber, it cures just that little bit around the tip of the fiber and nothing else. Really, really cool. And the rest is really just 3D printing. It just drags the fiber across, going zap, 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 zap. You rinse it off and you end up with benchies so tiny that you have to use a microscope to see them. Really crazy, amazing hacking, and I think kind of simple. watch the videos, you won't believe it. Like, he puts this drop of resin on the build plate, and because everything's so tiny, when he moves the fiber into it, it like capillaries up, and you're like, where did all that liquid come from? And then he lifts it up, and the puddle just flattens back out. That's because all of this is happening on such a darn tiny scale. And this little drop, this single drop of UV curing epoxy that he puts on there, is the whole pool in which he prints the object. He puts a drop down and just wiggles this head around inside that one drop. And that is the part. It's amazing. Like, there's this one scene where he rinses it off and, you know, pulls it out. And there's like nothing left on the piece of metal that he was using his print bed. And you're like, oh, that's horrible. And then it like zooms in and it's like, oh, that thing that's smaller than like a piece of salt is the Benchy. This is the best microprinting method you've ever seen. I mean, UV curing epoxy isn't non-toxic, but this only involves adding something non-toxic to it. So it's, you know, as safe as resin printing is. It uses a normal slicer and it makes what look like, with not super much calibration, amazingly nice resolution, ultra, ultra, ultra tiny parts.
That's crazy.
I kind of want to see if it's possible to scale it up. I mean, with this kind of resolution, it might be possible to do some amazing things. But at the same time, if this little grain of salt sized Benchy takes 10 minutes to print, it makes me wonder how many bazillion hours it would take to print anything macro scale with it.
One or two bazillion. Well, my next hack comes from Ian Summers. This clavichord is a well-tempered project. Now, what is a clavichord anyway? Well, it has nothing to do with your collarbones, although I personally do still associate bone-based musical instruments with the sounds of xylophones. If you're familiar with the works of Bach with regard to the, quote, well-tempered clavier, you have likely heard them performed on piano instead. So what's the difference? The clavichord is a distant precursor to the modern piano. While both have keys whose action strikes strings, the clavichord has far fewer, and each string is polyphonic, in an odd use of the word polyphonic. This instrument has 2 octaves, but only 10 strings, so each string sings 2 or 3 notes via dark keys that cover the sharps and flats. The resemblance to a piano ends where the keys whack the strings to make the sound. The clavichord does this directly, whereas a piano uses hammers and mechanisms. Now, Ian's clavichord isn't a pure reproduction of some historical example, and that's a bit of an anomaly in the world of early music, where authenticity is apparently obsessed over. But this just means that he was able to document his design decisions and explain his reasoning along the way. Be sure you check out the brief demo video to hear it in action, because it sounds great.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
Does it hit them or pluck them? Sounds plucky to me.
Yeah, that's a clavichord for you. Does it? I mean, it should be like a hammered dulcimer, kind of.
Wild. Striking brass or iron strings with small metal blades called tangent. Sounds good to me. Well, last up from me, a kind of analog electronics, maybe a little bit technical article from Elkem Tuff, the different ways to look at negative resistance. And this is pretty cool. He ran into negative resistance trying to make a gimmick 1-transistor oscillator. And I guess people wrote him back saying, hey, wait a minute, what is negative resistance anyway? That can't exist. And so part of this piece is saying, well, yeah, you're right, it can't exist. But you can have kind of locally negative resistance. And so what does any of this mean? Well, what is resistance, right? You put some voltage across the device and some amount of current flows. What that ratio is tells you what the resistance is, right? The higher the resistance, the less current flows, the more, the less. Ohm's law. V equals IR, except solve for R. On average, like from 0, you can't have negative resistance, because you could imagine if you could, you could make something that would basically generate power, which is to say the power the device uses would be negative. And that's basically falls out of power equals V squared over R, right? If you can imagine like an actual negative resistance, that device would consume negative power, and there's your free energy right there. But what negative resistance there is what's called negative differential resistance. And so if you think of a regular resistor, it kind of plots a line in this VI graph. Whereas if you think of something like a diode, it's a curve with a kink in it. The negative resistance trick is just that for some of this graph, it slopes the other way. it slopes the negative way. And that's totally useful because you can make, for instance, oscillators out of it like he was using before. Anyway, negative resistance is kind of esoteric, and maybe you only care about it in making odd oscillators, or, you know, if you're stuck with a device that exhibits this. Is this an analog electronics party trick? Amaze your friends? Probably is. If it doesn't deepen your understanding of Ohm's law just a tiny little bit, I don't know what's wrong with you. But basically, in the end of the day, it all boils down to things that we often think of as being a constant, like, you know, this resistor has this resistance. There's all sorts of nonlinear devices out there where that is not the case. Diodes, transistors. He makes a cool circuit that I'd never seen before, where he couples two JFETs together, puts them in a row, so the one turns the other on and the other turns the other off, and that makes a negative resistance device. Never seen that one before. Anyway, this is the kind of stuff you may not have seen in your introductory electronics course, but may never use in your professional life. Enjoy.
All right, so my last regular hack comes from Gadget Industry, and it's called There's a Whole Computer Inside This Mouse. Now, I'm not sure what's more impressive about this, the fact that there's a whole computer inside of a mouse, or the notion that Gadget Industry was able to harvest the necessary components from an old smartphone to make this work. The entire idea here revolves around an A-series Samsung phone, which has a feature called DEX mode, D little e capital X mode, which allows it to be used like a desktop. Once inside the phone, Gadget Industry removed the motherboard and the USB-C daughter board. He also harvested the battery and the little power button. But the phone battery was way too big to fit inside the mouse, so he switched over to a 3.7-volt power pouch. While this type of battery would normally last maybe 10 minutes on its own, it can be plugged into USB-C now and the phone will still run DeX. But when it came time to boot up the guts to verify that the system works as intended, the board wasn't happy at all and putting out a lot of heat that would normally be dissipated inside the phone by a metal frame. Then it was time to deal with the mouse so that everything will fit. The battery compartment was the first to go, and eventually he removed a necessary connector that was in the way and rewired it by hand. Now back to the heat problem. Gadget Industry dealt with this by adding two brass plates that are soldered together at a 90 degree angle. One face is screwed to the outside of the mouse and the other is under the motherboard. And finally, there was a power problem with the mouse part of the mouse, which still needs to work, obviously. This one took 1.5 volts, and since the battery is now 3.7, Gadget Industry had to add a buck converter. After all of that, and much more that you can see in the build video, he had a working mouse computer that is more than capable of playing 4K videos and Minecraft, to say the least.
I didn't realize until watching this video what the brass plate was all about. Thing. It's a cooling fin.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
And the board's thermally pasted to it, as you do.
I used to have a computer inside my keyboard.
Yeah.
My first quick hack comes from Nishant Joshi. If it's electronic paper, why not print to it? This takes an off-the-shelf e-paper display with a little microcontroller in it. He writes a fake printer emulator for it. So it hooks up to his Wi-Fi network, says, hey, I'm a printer, print to me, which means you can use your regular computer print to commands to print to this thing. And then it shows up on the e-paper. How crazy cool is that? It's an e-ink tablet that masquerades as a network connected printer. MIT CSAIL 3D printable lenticular indicators. This is either really cool or really stupid, or kind of both. It uses those like lenticular lenses. You probably know them from those like shifty image postcards or whatever. Or you can make stereograms out of them, actually. What, we used to get these in Cracker Jacks, little flippy things. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is this one slides the lens array so that you see either one image or the other as you move it up and down. And then they're just kind of rolling with this idea to see what they can do. Their kind of leading example is a bottle where you screw it together and the act of screwing it together pushes the lens down. So it changes essentially color from red to green when you tighten the bottle cap on. That's really cool. They have another example where the lenticular array is connected to a switch. So when you flip it up, it turns one color. And when you flip it down, the whole background plate flips the other so that you can tell if the switch is on or off. But if the switch is flipped up, it's on. And if the switch is flipped down, it's off. That one didn't quite hit home, but it looks hella cool. So go check this one out. It's an awesome design idea, and I'm sure you can make something cool out of it as well. Next up, a history video by Not What You Think. This is the helicopter with radioactive blades. 1950s, 1960s, the CH-53 Sea Stallion helicopter had problems with blades breaking off. So to tell when they've developed a crack, there was an initial system which included filling the blade with pressurized nitrogen gas and including a pressure gauge on the blade itself. So you could, when the helicopter was on the ground, see if it has enough pressure or if it's developed a crack somewhere. But you can't do that while the thing's flying. How can you tell? Today we have tire pressure sensors and you could just put one in it. But back then, 1960s, they didn't have that kind of electronics. So what did they put in there that you could read while the helicopter blades were spinning fast overhead? Strontium 90 and a Geiger counter in the helicopter. So the blade is filled with a radioactive material such that if the blade cracks, it will tip off the Geiger counter. Absolutely terrifying. This is the sort of stuff you can only get away with if you're the military. To be fair, 99% of the time, before they've developed the crack, they're not radioactive. And if you're flying around in a helicopter whose blades are cracking, would you rather get a tiny dose of radioactivity or a helicopter that plummets to the ground? Seems like a fair trade-off to me.
My first quick hack comes from Paul, a split keyboard designed for human hands. This keyboard, dubbed the Cogito, as in Cogito ergo sum, wasn't designed for just any human hands. It was designed specifically for Paul's, and Paul's only. Now this thing took more than 50 prototypes, as you might imagine. Rather than trying to get his hands to accommodate other keyboards, he embarked on an adventure to build the opposite. For one thing, the columnar stagger is tuned to his measured finger lengths. The pinky cluster is rotated to match what the pinky tends to do. And the thumb arc is meant to move you inward rather than outward. So basically, Paul's hands never have to move. Next up is Tracefinity. Tracefinity's Take Tool Photo Generate Custom Gridfinity Bin. For the uninitiated, Gridfinity is a modular system of bins and base plates that adhere to a standard. So, Tracefinity improves upon the idea pre-system by generating custom Gridfinity bins based on photos of tools. The system traces the outline and Bob's your uncle. Tracefinity also has handy features such as easy design adjustment and optional magnet holes. And you don't have to use them right away, because the system saves the outlines to a tool library, and you just use those to generate your bins whenever the time comes. Lastly, we have Brenopoly with anti-doomscroll Tamagotchi only lives if you do. Now, you can use your phone to do all kinds of stuff. Use it right, and you can even make yourself do stuff. But one of the great dichotomies of the smartphone era is that using them to ultimately keep yourself from using them is an interesting one, to say the least. Honestly, a dedicated device is probably the answer, along with some willpower. To that end, Brenpoly created a couple of virtual pets whose lives depend on his ability to keep from doomscrolling. These ESP32-based companions live in cute 3D-printed enclosures. One is a friendly cup of coffee, and the other is the oft-cited BMO from Adventure Time. Now, one aspect I'm not sure that I personally endorse is the use of an LLM here, which has access to screen time spent and notifications. It also runs a whisper model linked to a microphone inside the pets, so he can get the gist of notifications without looking at the phone.
All right, well, that brings us to our Can't Miss articles. These are long-form pieces written by our fantastic Hackaday writing staff. This week, I picked a talk from Hackaday Europe 2026, Outdoors with Robots, by Erin Kennedy, alias Robot Girl. Aaron's been building small robots for quite a while now, and some of them are functional, some of them are just plain fun, some of them are entirely whimsical. This whole talk, the premise is, once you've built your robots, you should take them outside. And why would you do this? For a bunch of reasons. A, outside is where the other people are. You can interact with people and have fun. Outside is where the environment is. She has a trash cleaning robot. She has to take that one to the beach. She has underwater robots. They need to deal with water. She has bots that run on wind power. And so while some of the time she's taking her bots out to the park to amuse other people with them or taking them to a high school for kids, the rest of the time the bot actually needs to be outside. Common denominator? Bots outdoors. Outdoors not as nice to the bots as your bench desktop. Or even your living room. That shag carpet gets you a little bit of the way there, but that's nothing compared to a sandy beach or being 30 meters underwater. This talk is full of kind of all of the lessons learned from taking her bots into all of these hostile neighborhoods for them, and you know, how you can deal with water, how you can deal with wind, how you can deal with sand, how you can deal with people, how you can, you know, deal with the wind blowing away your marker cubes for your vision reference points and things like this. If you think about it, like, imagine you took a Roomba and you put it out to the beach. How long would it last? 1 second? 2 seconds? You know, or if you've ever built, like, I used to build like all sorts of little remote controlled cars, tank things, et cetera, et cetera. And then you drive it outside and you're like, there's a log in the way that's just significantly bigger than it. And that's the end of your trip right there. You're not getting over that. How to deal with all of this is really fun, really challenging. And you get this incredible vibe from the video that half of it is she's having fun just throwing these challenges at her bots and at herself as the builder of them. But then sometimes she just wants to go on a hike, and she's actually using taking the robot out as an excuse to take herself and her friends out and to go on an adventure. And I just love the kind of almost symbiotic way that she's using the robots are using her. She's like, bring more batteries, but also bring some granola bars so you don't starve on the hike. The whole talk is this interesting mix of human, robot, art, interpersonal relationships. Absolutely lovely. And you can tell she's been having an absolutely fantastic time with all of these bots. The ones that she made to be like on a Mars simulation landscape as much as the pretty ones she took to a high school class. Don't be afraid to push your bots to places where they shouldn't go. Have them break and build them again stronger. Just a total aside anecdote, she entered the Hackaday Prize a long time ago with this beach cleaning robot. And I remember it back then. This was Bowie, it was called, and it was barely functional. But, you know, she had the first signs of real success there, right? Like, it was able to scoop through the sand and pick stuff up. But this early version of it, the clearance wasn't high enough, so it was getting sand in the motors. It had dead spaces in the 3D prints that would collect sand, so they would get heavier. Oh. As it was driving along and stuff. Flash forward 4 or 5 years, the current version of Bowie is phenomenal. And it's like, A, it's picked up some autonomy. B, it's got these like Mars rover inspired wheels that don't clog up and ride beautifully over sand dunes. It's really cool because A, you can kind of see this progress. B, she ends up with something that really is in the end almost like small scale Mars rover, but set up to a problem that's on this Earth instead of somewhere else. So you can pretty quickly and easily go test it and then try again. And I think that's the other thing that's really cool here. It's you know, one of the projects that uses the wind is actually a rolling bot that's meant to sail across possibly a Martian-like landscape. It's funny that this and a lot of her other robots are all kind of, by trying to exist in Earth's different biomes, are kind of also approaching the same problem that they have to put up, like Curiosity rolling around on Mars. Just in the like small hacker affordable fun sense instead of the multi-bazillion-dollar NASA project. But I think the inspiration and the spirit and the overcoming of the challenges and stuff actually is the same. Totally, totally inspirational talk. Go watch it.
Well, I gotta talk about this first.
Yeah, well, you can go watch it after we're done recording.
Okay, okay. Well, speaking of robots, sort of, outside, kind of, my can't miss comes from you as well. It is called Hunting the Wild Vibro Truck. Now, if your power went out nearly every time it was overloaded by everyone's air conditioners, or it rained, or the wind blew in a certain direction, you'd probably be interested in living somewhere with buried electrical lines. But if you live in Munich, the government is gearing up to go you one further by using underground water for geothermal heat and power sometime in the near future. The problem here is that the aforementioned water is up to 5 kilometers, which is about 3 miles, below the surface of the Earth. So how do you map it? Enter the Vibro Truck. These bad boys exist to pound the ground, sending shockwaves downward toward the water. Small boxen planted on the surface of the Earth listen for reflections from the water. The change in the speed of sound at the boundaries of the layers of different media cause these reflections. Apply a little math, and you can figure out how deep the water boundary is. At this point, after watching Elliot's first video, I started to wonder if these things are destabilizing the roads. Signs point to no when it comes to properly constructed roads, but the one in this video appears to be gravel or dirt, which is, I guess, why the guy with the broom gets paid to put the road back in order after the trucks move on. Is there rhyme or reason to the vibro trucking? Of course there is. The orange boxen, which are actually geophones, are planted at roughly 20 meter intervals in lines that are spaced about 300 meters apart. These run north-south, and then the vibro trucks run east-west, stopping every 20 meters to lower a large plate, which lifts the rest of the truck off the ground. Rather than pile-driving the ground, it applies a smooth and controlled oscillating vibration using specific and controlled frequency sweeps. Back to that in a minute. So apparently Munich has this great underwater store that's older than dirt and sits at 100 degrees Celsius. But how will they use it? Right now, the idea is to put geothermal plants around the city, drill large holes down 1 to 2 kilometers deep, and then drill diagonally to reach more water. This type of drilling has only recently become possible. But then how do you decide where the plants should go? Well, you have a 3D map of the underground, of course. At this point in the article, you get into the nitty-gritty of the audio, and you put a second video of the same vibro truck with filtered audio. And yeah, you can totally hear the frequency sweep, and it's kind of eerie, but it's kind of beautiful too. You may be wondering about the time of flight at this point. The individual geophones don't have a GPS time base because that would be too expensive. But when they install each geophone, they connect it to a laptop with GPS that records the location and sets the clock on the geophone. Then when they're harvested, they record the location again, dump the time data, and pull all of it down. Have you seen a big one yet?
I did. I was standing right next to the big one.
Like the big one that you'd say that the guy was like, too bad you missed the big ones or haven't seen the big ones? Okay.
That video up there is me right next to one of the big ones.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The one that is shaking the camera loose, actually. The one that I took the audio on is, it's funny, if you look at it, you could see it shaking the camera. That camera was on a tripod. It's rock solid. It's the ground that's shaking. I guess the camera was shaking. But it like turns the image into this horrible jello. It's really funny. Man, I was so pissed. I got back home and I listened to the audio on this and it was like just noise, you know, because the noise from the diesel engines and whatever on these things is so loud that I couldn't hear, you know, the vibrating the earth noise that I heard so distinctly when I was out there. And I'm like, what's gone wrong here? Maybe it was too low frequency. Maybe I'm just hosed. But I think it's because you're standing on the ground and it's being like literally transmitted into you directly. You hear that signal louder than it is, you know, through the air. It was really a wild experience. So that's why I put that filtered audio one there to try to, you know, at least give you some idea. Yeah, what a wild project. We ran into this because my wife was walking around and found the geophones all over our neighborhood. And what I think is a really cool outreach project, they put a QR code on each one and a little explanatory note that says, hi, I'm a geophone. We're doing the seismic thing. If you want to learn more, check this link out. And then they just tell you everything about it. I don't know. I ended up with a lot of questions, and by random chance, we had an engineer in my front yard, actually, as they drove down our street, and I kind of hammered him. And actually, in the comment section, and somebody sent me an email who works for the company that doesn't run the trucks, but runs the kind of logistics back end for the placement of the geophones and everything. So I may even get another. There may be a part two to the story. We shall see. Project's been going on for a couple weeks now and is due to go on for, I think, a few more months here before they're done. They're covering the whole city. It is funny, though, how many people wrote into the comments and said, oh, yeah, I've done some vibresis, apparently, is the official name for this. There are a bunch of different people who've worked for these kind of deep earth geological surveys. I had so much fun finding these things and running around and reading about this project. And the field itself is just this incredible mix of, you know, microelectronics and metrology and all of this for the geophones, plus this kind of logistical and synchronization issues for the vibro trucks. And then once you've collected all the data, there's like some heavy DSP math to figure out where all the boundaries are and do the 3D mapping. It's like the full stack, awesome hacker engineering project, but writ large to a city size scale. Really, really fun. Well, that wraps it up for this week's Hackaday podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Send your tips to tips@hackaday.com, your mailbags to mailbag@hackaday.com. And as always, you'll find the links at hackaday.com/podcast. And until next week,
keep on hacking. Double poop. There we go. Hooray. Textbook. Bring your flashlight.
Anyway, right. So, yeah, but let's do a Hackaday podcast.
Down for everyone, just me, just me.
And it ends up using kind of all of the... Hello. Well,
do you need to get that?
Nope, I'm working.
All right. Earbuds are nice, but they make my ears itch.
Frabba zabba zabba za.
Anti-doom scroll tomag... Damn it.
And I'm not going to commit to this on Hackaday, but...